I still haven't gotten over the spectacle that I witnessed on Tuesday evening. There were two older gentlemen arguing over each other, yelling at each other, laughing at each other, talking over each other. I really couldn't tell what anybody was saying. The meeting was not very informational. The person who was supposed to be in charge of keeping it in order had totally lost control. There was no accountability. I tell you what, I don't think I'll go back to our homeowners association meetings again. It just, you know, my son-in-law, Brian, did get elected to the board, and so hopefully things will turn around, but I'm not sure. Besides that, it made me miss the presidential election, a debate, so I hated to miss that. You know, they say politics is local. There's politics everywhere. You can't get away from it. There is arguing or differences of opinion. People have different ideas. Jesus knew that. Jesus was surrounded by politics, ecclesiastical politics within his own church, within his own faith, within the status quo of the Jewish people, and Roman politics, the politics of Roman Empire. Jesus was surrounded and in the midst of a swirl of politics and religion. So listen to this text out of the Gospel of Matthew. Now at the festival, the governor was accustomed to release a prisoner for the crowd, anyone whom they wanted. At that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Jesus Barabbas. So after they had gathered, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Jesus Barabbas or Jesus who was called the Messiah?" For he realized that it was out of jealousy that they had handed him over. And while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent word to him, "Have nothing to do with that innocent man, for today I have suffered a great deal because of a dream about him." Now the chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and to have Jesus killed. The governor again said to them, "Which of these two do you want me to release for you?" And they said, "Barabbas." Pilate said to them, "Then what should I do with Jesus who is called the Messiah?" And all of them said, "Let him be crucified." Then he asked, "Well, what evil has he done?" But they shouted all the more, "Let him be crucified." So when Pilate saw that he could do nothing, but rather that a riot was beginning, he took some water and washed his hands before the crowd, saying, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." Then the people as a whole answered, "His blood be on us and on our children." So he released Barabbas for them, and after flogging Jesus, he handed him over to be crucified. May the Lord bless the reading of this word. Now, during Holy Week before Easter, maybe you've heard the account of Barabbas, but maybe not. Maybe you heard it if you've attended the Tenebrae or Good Friday service. But all too often, we come to Palm Sunday and then back we come for Easter, and we miss a lot of the detail, or if we hear it, it doesn't register. I know I've never preached on Barabbas before, so I welcome this opportunity. So here's what you need to know about the context of what I just read to you. The Romans built empire, and they were really good at it. Really good at it. Roman roads, Roman military, they went out and conquered many different lands. And once they were conquered, they had to hold them together. They basically had two interests in the lands that they conquered. They wanted tax revenue, and they also wanted the natural resources from these countries. Other than that, the Romans were pretty indifferent. They really weren't that concerned with the people other than to keep them placated, to keep them quiet. They didn't need any restless people, certainly not rebellious people. And that's what the military presence was for, in order to maintain the peace. Pax Romana, I believe that they referred to it. Pontius Pilate was the governor that was sent there to lord over Judea. He had married the illegitimate granddaughter of Julius Caesar. And such that connection was good enough to get him connected, not good enough to get him sent to a plum appointment. So there he was in the sticks, in the outback, if you will, out there in a small land, a very arid land, with a small number of people who are very zealous in their pursuit of their religion and their pursuit of their God. Now, the Romans were good with that. The Romans had no interest in squelching people's religion. They knew that it was better just to let them go about their business. Whatever they did, they didn't understand it. They didn't believe in it, the Romans. But they allowed them to worship. In the case of Judea, they even allowed a puppet king in the person of Herod, one of their own, to be the king as long as his allegiance was to Rome, as long as he made sure that those bills got paid and the tax revenue came in. But we can understand Pilate being rather discouraged, having to be the governor. He didn't like the hubbub of Jerusalem. He didn't want to be in the midst of all the religious controversy. So it was for that reason that he lived in Caesarea by the sea, a beautiful seaside resort, if you will, where you could look out and see the marvelous azure blue of the Mediterranean every day. But it was the Passover. There was a lot going on, so he had to come into town. He was there, Pilate was there, and Herod came there also. So there was a lot going on. The pilgrims had all come in to the city as well. It was swelling. And also Jesus was there as well, this mystical Jewish rabbi, if you will. Jesus, who was homegrown, he was a Jew. As a boy, he came down with his parents from Nazareth. He went to the temple. He was devout. He went to the local synagogue in Capernaum. And there he learned the teachings. He learned the law. He learned his Torah. Jesus, who seemed to be a devout Jew, but now had sprung forth out of the wilderness with these strange teachings that claimed to be a fulfillment of the Hebrew prophets. Jesus, who was beginning to attract crowds. Jesus, who was performing miracles. Jesus, who was becoming a problem and a threat to the status quo. He was a hometown boy who had gone rogue. And now he was on their home turf, on the back steps there in Jerusalem. It's one thing to be out there 90 miles away, up there in Galilee, but now he had come to confront the status quo and the authorities right there at the temple. And that was not acceptable. They began to conspire to bring him down. They sent out goons, scholastic goons, if you will, who were steeped in the law. Pharisees and Sadducees who would ask him questions for the strict purpose of tripping him up. But Jesus was very nimble and able to argue and able to have dialogue with them. And they never seemed to be able to make him look foolish in front of his people, in front of his base. So finally, they had him arrested under the cover of night. He was taken before the council. There they condemned him for being a heretic, for claiming to be the king of the Jews. They knew what they wanted. They wanted him to be executed. But they would be unable to do that according to their own law, so they needed the cooperation of Pilate, the Romans. He was sent over to Pilate. You can only imagine the mystical feeling of Pilate being mystified. What do you want from me? I've got nothing to do with your internal affairs here. I don't want to get in the middle of this ecclesiastical matter. That's between you Jews. This is a family matter. And I think, you know what I think is that Pilate realized, maybe it stunned him, but the hostility toward Jesus was much greater than the hostility towards the Romans. And Jesus was one of their own. You know, I've encountered that dynamic before. I was in the Cotton Bowl a while back, years ago, when Auburn was playing Nebraska. It wasn't that exciting a game. I don't even remember the score when they came to halftime, but it had been sort of dull. There was a lackluster response from the crowd. And all of a sudden, in the middle of halftime, when, you know, the band had played and they're leaving the field, there was nothing going on in the field. All of a sudden, half of the stadium stood to its feet and began to cheer a loud ovation, louder than anything that had gone on during the game. And I was, for the life of me, I couldn't understand what in the world is going on here. I don't see anything on the field. And finally, I realized what had happened. They had flashed on the scoreboard the score of the bowl game that Alabama was playing in, and Alabama was losing. And that made the Auburn fans so happy that their in-state rival was losing. You see what I mean? There's something about a family affair, the feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys, that's much more hostile, much more intense than even the rivalry with outsiders. And that's what was going on here. And that's why Pilate didn't want to get involved. Besides that, his wife had sent word to him that she'd had a dream about this Jesus and that she instructed him, he is innocent. Do not do him any harm. You know, it's one thing to get the Sadducees and the Pharisees mad at you. It's another to get your spouse unhappy with you. One lasts for a couple of days. The other can last a lifetime. So what was Pilate supposed to do? Well, he had already sentenced Jesus. He said, I don't see any that this man has done any harm. He sent him to Herod, and Herod said the same thing. Herod kicked him back to him. So he said, well, I guess you should be, we'll beat you. You'll be beaten, and then we'll release you. But there was a tradition for Passover in which the governor had the ability to release one of the captives in response to the request of the crowd that gathered in the courtyard. So the crowd had gathered, and so Pilate had an idea, a way to just release Jesus and get out from the middle of this conundrum in which he found himself. So he thought to himself, well, it'll be a no-brainer. On the one hand, we'll drag out this Barabbas, who's a murderer, a rebel, an insurrectionist, whose activities of sabotage had led to the death of an individual. So Barabbas, who was slated to be crucified, or Jesus of Nazareth, the healer, who preaches peace. I mean, that's pretty much a no-brainer. You can see that Pilate was just so pleased with himself that he'd figured out how he was going to approach this. The only problem was what he didn't know was the Jewish authorities had planted people of their own, employees of the temple, and stirred them up and instructed them that they were to call for Barabbas to be released, not Jesus. Barabbas, not Jesus. The fix was in. So when Pilate gave them the choice, the people yelled, "Release Barabbas." Pilate said, well, what about this Jesus? What do you want me to do with him? You could sense his exasperation. He didn't even know himself. But it was almost as if the people said, well, you've already planned a crucifixion. You got the cross already. Don't crucify him. Crucify him. Crucify Jesus. Pilate was beside himself. He gave up. Fine. Release Barabbas. Crucify Jesus. It was purely political. Jesus was executed as a result of these politics there in Jerusalem. Now, of course, that's not to take away from the divine plan. We understand this was part of God's plan for salvation. But in order to make that happen, the circumstances were such that they were very political. We asked the question, should politics and religion mix? And I'm not sure about that answer, but one thing's for sure, they do mix all the time. One had taken a life, the other had saved lives. You know, there's a movie made in 1961 called The Night Became Day. It was about Barabbas. Stacy Keach played Barabbas. Rod Steiger played Pilate. And in the movie, the Gospels don't say anything about Jesus talking to Barabbas. But in the movie, Barabbas seeks out Jesus before either one of them had been arrested, and he tries to recruit him. You are so prominent. You have a following. We've got the soldiers. We have the rebels. We can overthrow these Romans. All we need is for you to give us your blessing and stand before us, and the people will rally behind us, Jesus. Join us. Be our leader. Be our commander. And Jesus looks Barabbas in the eye, and he says, Barabbas, love your enemies. Barabbas, do not take up a sword, because those who use the sword will perish from the sword. Forgive those who persecute you. And Barabbas is incredulous. I'm sorry, did you not hear me? Do you not get what's going on here? The Romans are oppressing us. The Romans have conquered us. The Romans are brutal. They've killed hundreds and hundreds of our people. And we need vengeance, and we need liberty, and we need to overthrow them. But Jesus did not give him the answer that he wanted, so he walked away in frustration. That was not what Barabbas wanted to hear. And you know what? Many times, it's not what we want to hear either. This whole nonviolent business, this whole forgive those who persecute you, this whole love your enemies business. Jesus was nonviolent, but many people are not. Violence, that which coerces through physical harm or intimidation, that which hurts and draws blood, that which throws people to the ground and injures them. The Book of Resolutions and the United Methodist Book of Discipline says that we respect the right to protest, but we do not condone violence. Knowing that the powerful witness of civil disobedience is often discredited when it resorts and erodes into violence. Now, not everyone agrees. Just like Barabbas did not agree with Jesus, not everyone agrees. 2 years ago, there was a man who was sentenced to 3 years probation. He had been a part in California, there in Berkeley. He'd been a part of a protest. There were two groups opposing each other, yelling at each other, challenging each other. That's in the tradition of peaceful protest. But suddenly this man jumped out from the people in which he was in their midst, and he had something in his hand, and he threw it down and struck three people on top of the head and then turned around and ran away. He was wearing a mask. It was before the pandemic. He was still wearing a mask, and he ran away. Nobody knew who he was. He'd attacked these people. Somebody had a video of it, and somehow they were able to identify him. They tracked him down and arrested him. It turned out that he was a professor at a local community college. And he taught ethics. And obviously embedded in his scheme of what constituted correct ethics was the ability to commit violence against those who disagreed with you. Not everybody agrees with nonviolence. Sometimes people want to fight. You know, I see that when I watch the newsreels and I see the young people going through the streets of our cities at night. Some of them are protesting and they're organized and they have the signs and they're peaceful. Others are not, as they run and they're committing destruction and maybe even fighting with each other. I get a vibe from that as I watch it and I say, those people are looking for a fight. They want to fight. Reminds me of the Rolling Stones song, Street Fighting Man. It was an anthem of the 60s. Sort of a way of serenading the riots that were taking place in American cities back then. I remember the story of a friend of mine who was in the Doctor of Ministry program at Perkins with me. Reverend William, I guess I should say Dr. Willie Champion. He got the degree as well. And Willie was talking about the AME church where they went to annual conference. And there was a lot of controversy and argumentation that was going on, and people were getting heated and it was getting hostile. And finally the bishop said, my brothers and sisters, we will take a moment and we will pray. We will pray together. And one petite grandmotherly woman went to microphone three and she said, Bishop, we don't want to pray, we want to fight. Sometimes, human nature being what it is, we want to fight. Remember in the movie The Godfather, Godfather 1, where Clemenza, a member of the family, is teaching young Michael how to make spaghetti. And then he also explains, look, every 7 or 8 years, we've got to go to the mattresses. There's going to be bloodshed. We've got to fight it out to decide the status quo. Who's going to be in charge? We have to struggle again between the families to decide, you know, who's going to be in charge. And so it's easy to give in. There's something seductive about violence. We get angry and we want to give in and we want to be a part. We want to strike out. We began to redefine the task of faith as being, you know, what we're really called to do is hate the right people. And if you hate the right people, then you're truly a Christian. If you can deem and vilify and demonize those people, and we can all hate the right people together, then we're being faithful. But there's domestic violence and gang violence and police violence and criminal violence and military violence and religious persecution around the world. And if we all give in, what's going to come of God's creation? And how in the world will we approximate the kingdom of God? You see, the irony is Jesus was executed for the sins of Barabbas. He who was totally innocent and was teaching and preaching and peace, he was executed on behalf of another. The guilty one was let go. You see, politics and religion get mixed up all the time. And that obscene miscarriage of justice becomes the platform, the foundation upon which our salvation is based. As we understand that in God's initiative and God's grace, God takes on all of our sins and forgives them in the person Jesus Christ. Now, the gospel doesn't say what happened to Barabbas. We can only imagine. I think of two things that come to my mind. Either he came out and he said, "I don't get it. I did the crime. I knew I was preparing myself for being executed, and here I am released, and it's done something to my heart. It's changed me, and I see life in a different way, and I want to go out, and I want to be a peacemaker, and I want to transform the world in a different way. I want to destroy my enemies still, but I want to do it by transforming them into friends." Maybe he went that way, or maybe Barabbas went, "Oh, great, I'm freed up for another battle," and he went out and got killed at some point and was a casualty. Did he change his tactics or did he continue? You and I, we've been liberated in a sense. We've been released when we have a sense of our justification by virtue of Jesus Christ, accepting Christ. We've been forgiven. We've been released from the oppression of human sin. We have the same dilemma. What are we going to do with it? Are we going to say, "Great, I'm freed up to go out and sin some more. May I sin all the more so that grace might abound until my next confession? Or shall I begin to change and see life in a different way and see myself as a conduit for God's graceful love?" You know, it was President Abraham Lincoln who said, "A house divided against itself cannot stand." And I believe that. And frankly, I get more and more concerned about our own nation, our own society, as we appear to be increasingly polarized, increasingly less politically tolerant of each other. I don't know if it's happened to you. Have you ever gotten ready to go to an event, maybe go to some people's houses or some sort of conversation or go to dinner? I know in the pandemic, that's probably few and far between. But even on a Zoom call, do you find yourself talking to your spouse saying, "Remember, don't talk politics. Don't bring that up. We don't want to be in the middle of that." I have a Zoom meeting every now and then with some old college buddies. And my dearest friend, he was my roommate. We played football together. He is just adamant about pontificating about politics and how he feels so strongly about things and about certain individuals, and he just sort of drones on and dominates the conversation. And as much as I love him, I don't really care to listen to the political pontificating, because I sit there and he drones on and with the understanding he really doesn't care about my opinion at all. He just wants me to know it's obviously self-evident. Any reasonable person thinks this, this, and this. And I find myself being transported back to sixth grade, back to the beginning of school, when you'd reunite with all of your classmates, and some of them had been to Bible camp for all summer long, and they come back from a denomination not to be named, and they tell you, "You haven't really been baptized, and you're not really saved. And chances are, you're probably going to go to hell." And when I heard that, even back in sixth grade, I did not experience the love of God through Jesus Christ. Instead, I felt rejected and I felt judged. And I feel the same way when a secular person is talking secular matters and really doesn't give a darn about my opinion. Sanctimony and self-righteousness in any context is not acceptable and is not appealing. You know, I was in Lonesome Dove when Captain Call said to Gus, "You'd argue with a possum." And some people like to argue. And I can respect that. Some people enjoy getting things roused up and getting the people all upset about things. I'm not one of those people. Maybe I'm conflict averse. But I prefer to be the glue that helps put things back together. Let's, you know, people talk about moderates. You know, who's got any use for moderates? They go, well, on the one hand this, and on the other hand that. Oh, well, you're no good. You're not aligning with the opinion that I want. But somebody's got to be able to listen to both sides and hold them together. So here's three takeaways that I'd suggest from our story about Jesus and Barabbas. First of all, seek first to understand. This is the old Stephen Covey maxim. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. You know what that involves? It involves listening. A willingness to listen. I listened recently to a TED Talk by a fellow by the name of Rob Willer, and he says, you know, he did a study with conservatives and progressives, and he got two groups together, and they talked about how are you going to convince the other side to your viewpoint, and he gave them an assignment, write an essay that's going to persuade the other side to your viewpoint. And what was fascinating was knowing the values of both of those groups, knowing the importance of being equitable and equal for the progressives, and knowing the importance of patriotism and tradition and safety and security for the conservatives, neither group made any effort at all to appeal to the values of the other. Instead, they simply repeated their own values, trying to pound the other group into submission. And guess what? It doesn't work. It does not work, being pounded into submission. Care enough, listen enough to dial in to the other person's world and seek to understand. Number two, try to engage in person. Now, I know you're saying, John, are you not aware there's a pandemic going on? Yes, I know that. But to the extent that you can, maybe on October 11th, you go to somebody's yard, one of our members, and you're a part of that yard gathering, try to gather in person. We need, as human beings, we need food, we need water, we also need community, and we are starving for fellowship. Ours is an incarnational faith in which God cared enough to come in person, and we need to do the same thing. I don't know about you, I'm sick of Zoom meetings. You've got Zoom meetings and all the, it's like Hollywood Squares. Where in the world is Paul Lynde when you need him? You know, you're sitting there and Bob, you need, your mic is muted, Bob. You know, oh, you're not hearing me. Oh, it went out. It's just ridiculous. Very frustrating. And you go on the internet and these anonymous posts, the things that people say anonymously. Have you ever read an article in a magazine or on the website and then gone to the comments afterwards and read the terrible things that people say to one another? And you know what makes that possible? Because they're anonymous and they're not speaking to each other in person. Going back to my days when I worked in the New York Garment District, I was a Texas kid. I thought it was fascinating, the New York Garment District. And I had customers on 37th Street, and when it would happen every now and then that the mill in South Carolina was late on their deliveries of sending up fabric or piece goods to the customer so that they could make their garments, they would call me, and they spoke to me in a way as a Texas kid I had never heard before. And they used words I'd never heard before. I learned my Hebrew on 37th Street, but some of these words can't be preached. And finally, when it got to be a little too abusive, I would hang up the phone, get my coat, get in the elevator, go down, walk out of 1430 Broadway, go down three blocks and go over to 37th Street, go into their building, go up the elevator, walk in their showroom and ask to see them by name, and they would come out in person, and generally, usually I would stand over them and say, I'm sorry, we had a bad connection. Is there something you wanted to say to me? And it was amazing how the tone of the conversation would change because we were talking eye to eye and we were talking in person. So when you can, seek out fellowship. Be socially distanced, wear your mask, but just know that we need fellowship every bit as much as we need food and water. Try to engage in person. And finally, be a reconciler. You be the glue that helps people hold together. You know, I remember my pastoral care professor at Bright Divinity School. Howard Stone, he told a story, I've never forgotten it, about a husband and wife who were doing marital counseling with him. And it was, they had been married for a long time, and as they started to share and talk, they talked over each other, they yelled at each other, you know, maybe they were in their own presidential debate, I don't know. But finally, it was so frustrating, he called time out, took the husband by the arm to another room, and he said to him, do you want to save your marriage? And the guy said, yeah. And he said, well, then here's what you do. When I give you the nod, I want you to say four magic words. Are you willing to do that no matter what I say? And reluctantly, the husband said, yes, I will. What are the words? So he told him the words. They went back into the room, and the wife began to tell her story. And it kind of got off track, and she said, and Dave never keeps the garage clean. He's always doing his projects, and he leaves a big mess for me to trip over. I can't even get my car in. And Howard Stone looked at the husband, and he gave the nod, and the husband said the four magic words. You know what they were? The husband said, you may be right. She didn't hear it. She kept going on. And when you keep making those messes, you know, it begins to mark up, and with the walls of the garage have been disfigured. And, you know, what are we going to do? I don't like living in a mess like that, and you don't seem to care. Stone looked at the husband again. He gave the nod. He said, honey, you may be right. She didn't hear that either. It took four different times between he finally said, she was in the middle of a sentence, and he said, you may be right. He said, and one other thing, and she stopped, and she turned, and she looked at her husband, realized what he had said, and she burst into tears. Because for the first time in a long time, she felt validated, and she felt like her husband cared enough to hear her. And she threw her arms around her, and thus the healing was to begin. We live in a challenging world, but be careful about being hateful or adamantly opposed to others. Don't allow yourself to get violent because it will invalidate your message. Other people may indeed be right or at least have a valid point. When we make other people feel loved and valued, we witness to the power of God. It's a radiant energy that says, you know what? I love you, and there's not a darn thing you can do about it. Would you pray with me? Oh God, we thank you for the power of your love. We live in a challenging world that causes us to feel polarized and unhappy and to disagree. Lord, let us be the peacemakers. Help us to be the glue. Let us listen carefully and go out and agree to that, at the very least, that yes, you're right. You do feel that way, don't you? And to validate the humanity of those around us. We do this in the name and the image of Christ Jesus. Amen.